Sorry. Good morning. I would like to call this Human Services, Finance, and Policy meeting to order. We have a quorum present. Chair Schumacher, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I would move the minutes from March 20th, 2025.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. And first up, we have Rep. Fisher with House File 2196. Representative Fisher, would you like to move your bill in front of the committee?
Yes, I'd like to move my bill, please. And thank you for the opportunity. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to present the bill today. We'll mention that I do have an A1 author's amendment I'd like to move. And the amendment does two things. First of all, the first part of the line point 1-2, where we're on pages 47 to 50, deleting sections 56 to 58. This area does not really fit with this part of the statute anymore, and so what's being done is removed. It's going to be added into a bill that's going to be coming before this committee tomorrow. So that's what's happening in this area. It's having to do with the residential treatment. And then the second part, line 1.3, this was some technical assistance from the Department of Human Services. I would ask for your support.
Members, are there any questions or discussions about the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes. Representative Fisher, to your bill.
Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2196. While this is a very long, lengthy bill, it's actually pretty simple because what we're doing is we're just changing terminology here, updating terminology basically around the word emotional disturbance. And instead of using emotional disturbance and serious emotional disturbance, we're changing to mental illness and serious mental illness. These are the terms that we are now using these days, and this is just to reflect those changes. It does not change the definition or criteria of what emotional disturbance is. And then the other change that is happening in here is it's helping separate the children's mental health system from the child protection system. And what is happening here is we use the term of out-of-home replacement, and when it's used in the child welfare system, it's to refer to children being placed out of home due to abuse or neglect. In children's mental health, this is not the reason children are leaving the homes. They are leaving to receive more intensive treatment. So instead of out-of-home placement, we want to use the terms residential treatment or therapeutic foster care to relay the fact that the children are receiving treatment and not anything because of child protection. And with that, I will have my testifier.
Forget that every time. Thank you and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, your title, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Wabderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. As Representative Fisher pointed out, this is really a very straightforward bill. During my over 20 years at NAMI Minnesota, I have seen a great deal of confusion between the terms emotional disturbance and emotional or behavioral disorder, and they are not the same, but they sound the same. Parents whose children fall into the emotional behavioral disorder category in special education sometimes think that their child then has a diagnosis of a mental illness or falling into the emotional disturbance category under the Children's Mental Health Act, but they haven't. In fact, if you Google the term emotional disturbance, you almost always come up with an explanation related to special education. Parents of children are no longer afraid of the term mental illness. They know what it means. They know that what depression and anxiety are, so let's not shy away from the correct term. For decades, NAMI Minnesota has worked to separate out the children's mental health system from the child protection system. Decades ago, families actually had to relinquish custody to the county in order to access residential treatment. That changed, but families still had to go through the child protection system, but could agree to a voluntary placement, meaning they retained decision-making over the child's care, but still had to file papers with the court. More recently, we created the third pass so these families wouldn't have to go through the child protection door at all, but unfortunately, the rate for room and board was set so low that families are still today having to go through child protection. I know there is a bill to actually increase that rate. And so the second change is to replace the term out-of-home placement, which again is a child protection term, and use a more accurate term, residential treatment or therapeutic foster care. Some might wonder why the bill couldn't have just instructed the revisor's office to change out these words, but we learned it didn't quite work that way. So I did spend time going through every time it was used in statute to ensure that we were actually using the correct terms. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll call testimony closed. And members, questions, discussion about the bill? Representative Backer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, what's the main reason for changing language from emotional disturbance to mental illness? I mean, how will that allow us to provide better service?
Thank you.
To whoever wants to
tell. Madam Chair, Representative. Because if a family is trying to figure out what's going on with their child and you do emotional disturbance, it doesn't really come up with things like anxiety, depression, you know, early onset schizophrenia. And so we call all those things mental illness. We don't really, in normal language, call them emotional disturbance. We don't use that term for adults either. So we just want to make it clear. And I've had many families call who actually thought that because they were in their child was in special ed under the EBD category, they actually thought their child did have a diagnosis of mental illness when they didn't, and they didn't access the treatment that their child needed.
Thank you. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. So that was going to kind of lean into my question. The work that we're doing in attendance, we're realizing words matter. Mm-hmm. School district over to DCYF, child welfare, how that all maneuvers. So can you tell us how you're working with those other agencies to make sure that we're all using the same language? Because the minute that it leaves one house and goes to another, it's a completely different definition with different outcomes. So I like what you're doing here. It's really like leaning into correct support and family preservation. Just interested to know how we're breaking down those silos.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Keeler. We've actually changed the term throughout. So even in the education statutes, when they referred to emotional disturbance or serious emotional disturbance, we put in the terms mental illness. In the child protection statute, when they used emotional disturbance, we put in the words mental illness, so that throughout all of the different systems, whenever we see, you know, when we really want to call it a mental illness, that language is now there.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you. I think that's great. I think we should kind of take practice in that and a lot of the other things that we do as we update terminology in different spaces just to make sure that the continuum of support is consistent. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Seeing none, Representative Fisher, close your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee, for the opportunity to present the bill. Looking forward to having the support and having part of the final bill. Thank you.
And with that, members, House File 2196 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next, we have a presentation from Kylie Ann Stevens with DCT. Members, due to the robust agenda, I'm going to have to ask that questions be held until we get to the bill presentation. Once you get settled, Kylene, please feel free to start your presentation. State your name and title for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Kylene Stevens. I am the Executive Medical Director for the Department of Human Services Direct Care and Treatment Division. Thank you for your time today to discuss the work of the Priority Admissions Review Panel. I'll begin with a brief background on the issue. Chapter 253B allows for a person to be civilly committed to the commissioner of the Department of Human Services. In 2010, the average wait time for admission to Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which I will probably refer to from now on as AMRTC, was 19 days. By 2013, it increased to 30, and that's when the priority admissions law was enacted. It prioritized individuals being held in jail for admission to DHS facilities within 48 hours. This resulted in faster hospitalization from jails for the first few years. This graph shows that the trend for all priority admissions to DCT programs from the law's inception through 2024, As you can see, the first year DCT admitted 48 people, but last year admitted 424, quite an obvious increase over the past decade. And this really demonstrated an increase in demand. In addition, civil commitments increased by 36% during the same time, exacerbating the demand for DCT beds. This made it very difficult to admit people from jails within 48 hours and greatly reduce access for others seeking admission from hospitals, for example. This law has created a concentration of highly symptomatic individuals in DCT facilities, creating safety concerns as well. Civilly committed patients waiting in community hospitals have virtually no chance of being admitted to DCT hospitals and facilities. Several lawsuits have been brought against the state for failure to admit people within 48 hours during this period of time. In 2023, the legislature amended the 48-hour rule to clarify that patients must be admitted to from jails within 48 hours of a medically appropriate bed becoming available. It also gave counties a two-year stay from fees from do-not-meet-criteria patients under certain circumstances. And it created the Priority Admissions Task Force. The task force was charged with evaluating the impact of the Priority Admissions Law and to make recommendations to the legislature on this issue. Key stakeholders make up the membership of the task force, co-chaired by former DHS Commissioner Jody Harpstead and Attorney General Keith Ellison. Members are listed here for you. The task force issued a report with 9 recommendations in February of 2024. Briefly, they were to immediately begin to increase capacity at DCT, form a joint incident collaboration to actively facilitate discharges, approve an exception to the priority admissions law for up to 10 patients in community hospitals, create and implement a new priority admissions criteria to DCT facilities, increase access to services provided in the community, provide funding to administer medications to people in custody, relieve counties of some cost for individuals awaiting transfer to other DCT facilities, expedite Minnesota Section 1115 waiver, and increase forensic examiner accessibility. Last session, the legislature took several actions to address these recommendations in the report, and I'll highlight just a few of these. Funding was granted to design a new 50-bed facility on the Anoka campus to expand DCT capacity. A new priority admissions framework was approved for admissions, which takes into consideration factors other than wait time alone. MA payments for community-based services were approved, and cost of care changes were approved, and debt forgiveness for 2 counties. Additionally, a new task force for MIND commitments was created. An exception for 10 hospitalized patients was granted. Funding for medications in jails was provided through a pilot, and a pilot for DCT to survey and provide support for jails was directed. And finally, the legislature established the Priority Admissions Review Panel, the reason we're here today. The Priority Admissions Panel was convened by Commissioner Harpstead and Attorney General Ellison, made up of all the same task force members, as well as 1 new member appointed by labor organizations. The panel had 3 tasks: to evaluate specifically the 48-hour timeline for priority admissions and submit a report to the legislature, advise the DHS commissioner on the effectiveness of the new admissions framework, and review de-identified data quarterly for 1 year to ensure that the new framework was being implemented and applied equitably. As a refresher, these are the review panel members, and the only new member is Lynn Butcher, who is appointed as a member of a labor union. The review panel reviewed data from the national landscape on this issue. As a part of this, a DHS consultant conducted an analysis of publicly available data for all 50 states and Washington, D.C. It showed that people waiting in jails for state hospital beds is a widespread issue, but only 12 states have timelines for admission. Deadlines range from 7 days to 60 days. Minnesota has the most stringent timeline of 48 hours. I'm going to stress that again. Minnesota is the only state that requires admission within 48 hours. At least 24 states have experienced litigation over timelines for admission. 10 states of the 12 who have deadlines continue to have significant delay in admissions, suggesting that those deadlines do not solve the problem of wait times. Oregon and Washington, the remaining 2 states, have invested billions to reduce wait times, including millions in contempt fines and court fees. The review panel, through its work, made 6 recommendations in the report. I will cover each of these briefly. I will note that the panel came to a unanimous decision on all 6 of these recommendations. First, expand access to care in DCT and in the community. First, expanding access to care at DCT includes funding of the addition of a 50-bed facility on the campus of Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. The next recommendations serve to increase community capacity, increasing Medicaid rates for community and hospital providers, increased funding for first episode of psychosis and bipolar disorder programs, increased funding for mobile crisis teams, and establishing a task force on transport holds and providing education to law enforcement. DCT is an important part of the continuum of care, but the panel recognizes that it cannot be the only part of care. If you conceptualize a 12-inch ruler with the representing the continuum of care of behavioral health services in the state, DCT really represents that last inch, that 12th inch. So we recognize that we need to expand access to care along the rest of the ruler, if you will, as well. The panel recommended to extend the sunset provision for 2 years, during which time the legislature must develop DCT and community capacity. Specifically, continue the current medically appropriate bed language in statute. This helps to ensure safe admissions and reduce litigation fees. This provides time to invest in expanded capacity and to measure progress while not setting unrealistic expectations about how quickly these things can be accomplished. And the review panel wants to continue to meet during this 2-year period of time as well. The review panel recommends increasing data sharing and transparency by having DCT create a publicly accessible dashboard with referral data by making admissions policies easier to access. Provide basic mental health care in jails. This would require funding to ensure collaboration in the community to provide an outpatient level of mental health care in jails. And the panel recommends continuing DCT's pilot consultation program and funding for long-acting injectable antipsychotic medications for people waiting in jails. Continue the does not meet criteria payment relief to counties for clients under certain situations. And this provides relief to counties in situations where they have no ability to influence the timeline surrounding discharge. It also allows DCT to review situations on a case-by-case basis to determine if a downward adjustment is appropriate. And finally, the panel wishes to renew the exception for up to 10 patients waiting in community-based hospitals to be prioritized for admission to a DCT bed. This has been successful this year by helping to relieve pressures faced by community hospitals for patients who need a higher level of support but previously were unable to access it because of the 48-hour rule. Thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your presentation. And members, we're clipping along here, so we do have maybe 10 minutes for questions or comments, if anybody's interested.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation on the task force for the priority admission. I know some of these recommendations were also from the prior, task force recommendation. What was the difficulty of removing, because we are the only state that uses 48-hour rule? I understand that we have to expand the capacity, we have to make some adjustment and changes. What is the hold for just completely removing the 48-hour rule from the system?
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, thank you for the question. We had a lot of discussion about that question, which is, does the 48-hour rule make sense at all? And quite simply, there was not unanimous consent to remove it entirely. The best we were able to do was to extend the sunset provision of the medically appropriate bed language for a period of 2 years to allow for ongoing monitoring of the situation. But that was certainly a discussion point.
Chair Noor, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that question also, Dr. Stevens, you talked about extending the hospital's admission. Usually we prioritize folks who are living from jail to DCT. Do we have any waiting list at this point? I know we cleared that list of 10 individuals from the last adjustment that we made.
Director?
Thank you. Yes, we do maintain a waiting list for individuals in a variety of settings, including community-based hospitals. I don't have the numbers for the waiting list committed to memory this morning, but I can certainly provide those to the committee if needed. But 10 patients is a very small number of hospital referrals. We really have had to limit those exceptions to people who have extraordinary need online with what individuals waiting in jails have.
Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a work in progress, so thank you again for the report, and I look forward to working with my colleagues to find solutions for this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Stevens, question around how many task force and review panels are there around DCT?
There's two right now. Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Thank you. There's two happening right now. The Priority Admissions Task Force turned into the review panel. So that's the official terminology now. Same people except one additional member. And then there is a mentally ill and dangerous task force happening, which is focused specifically on the patient population at the Forensic Mental Health Program in St. Peter.
Representative Gilman.
So then a quick follow-up. Thank you, Chair. So do we have, I saw that there was fines happening, you know, billions invested in other states and then fines happening. Do we have fines happening here in Minnesota if beds aren't available? Thanks.
Director.
Representative, yes, we do. So we have the cost of litigation for lawsuits that are happening now. And what we've learned from other states is there are, you know, extraordinary costs for that and then also penalties associated with failure to meet required deadlines in those other states, which, as you mentioned, are longer than our states.
Representative Gilman.
Okay, great. So I would just love, at some point, could we see where that's sitting, where our fines are sitting? Like, are we in the tens of thousands? Are we in the millions of taxpayer dollars going towards these fines, things like that?
Director Stevens.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that work was completed as part of the Priority Admissions Review Panel, and we can provide that after the meeting today.
Thank you. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I do see that you had a sheriff on one of the task force, which is great. What feedback have you got from law enforcement about the 48-hour rule instead of just that one individual? For the ones that are for it, what are they saying? The ones who are against it, what's they're saying? Because you always have two sides of the story.
Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I'm certainly not an expert in the opinion of law enforcement across. We've certainly heard from Sheriff Welk, who's a member of the task force and a very strong partner in this work, that the 48-hour, that people are suffering in jails and people need mental health care in jails. And that's something that the panel certainly recognizes and see as a critical need. So that's probably the extent of what I feel comfortable how representing the law enforcement perspective on this issue.
Representative Becker.
And I appreciate your answer. I'm not looking for you to, say that you know law enforcement. I'm just looking for feedback, you know what I'm saying? And I'm just cautious that we're getting only one individual. We're making a significant change with the 48-hour rule and so forth. And I deal with mental health individuals on ambulance runs. So I get the challenge, and I also understand that our deputies are not mental health counselors. That's all, they're not trained. I would like to see if there's anybody saying, you know, hey, it works. To me, that's what a task force is to reach out to that. And I know police, if it's deputy, if it's city, if it's not so much highway, but definitely handles a lot of that. So it'll make a big change when it comes to law enforcement. So thank you. That's my comment. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Director, do you have anything to say to that?
I would just add that everyone involved in the task force, there were 18 members, recognizes that there are unmet mental health needs in the state of Minnesota. Our focus was on the 48-hour rule specifically and recognizing that DCT only has the capacity it has. There's no beds that are sitting waiting to be used. We're at above 90% capacity, I think 93 or 94 capacity across direct care and treatment. So speaking for direct care and treatment in this moment, it's important to make sure that we're able to admit people safely to our programs and not put ourselves under regulatory risk, as well as create unsafe conditions for our staff and the patients we serve.
Thank you. Anybody else have a question? Representative Gordon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, what is the average wait time right now for people to get a bed?
Director Stevens.
Representative, was there a particular program that you had in mind?
Representative Gordon.
Just generally speaking, I guess. I mean, maybe that's just information that you could send to us offline, too, but.
Director Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, for the question. The last time we pulled the dashboard, and we can make that available to you as well, is our programs like Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, that the programs in that division, wait time is less than 30 days. Our most significant wait time right now by far is at the Forensic Mental Health Program, and the wait time there is, if I'm remembering correctly, around 300 days. So it's quite significant, and that relates specifically to the length of stay for individuals in St. Peter at the Forensic Mental Health Program. It's years, not months or days.
Representative Gordon, follow up?
Nope, that's all I had. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, and members, with that, I think we're going to move on. Representative Fisher. House File 2586 is next on the docket. Representative Frederick, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 2586 be before the committee and for be laid over for possible inclusion in the committee bill.
Perfect. Thank you. Representative Frederick, describe your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we've had a lot of conversation already this morning about the priority admission process. And so what this is the bill from the Priority Admission Task Force. And I want to talk about kind of two different things. One is the 48-hour rule. And there's essentially three different stakeholders in three different kind of positions on this. The counties are in one position where they want the 48-hour rule back in play right now. I think there's a bill that's floating out there to that effect. My DCT bill is kind of the other bookend to that line, where it says we should get rid of the 48-hour rule altogether. And then this bill kind of represents that middle ground that says we should continue the suspension that we put in play 2 years ago for another 2 years while this work continues. And then the other piece that goes hand in hand with this is the county cost share, again, on the county side, who want the 48-hour rule. They want the county cost share completely be removed altogether. The other bookend, where it is get rid of the 48-hour rule, they want the county cost share in place. So, again, this bill before us is that middle ground where it suspends the 48-hour rule for another 2 years and also suspends the county cost share during that timeline. So I want to highlight that is the position of this bill. At the same time, all three of these bills before me are so interconnected, my brain is putting them all in one, so I just want to make sure I'm talking about the right bill at the right time. So it reestablishes the Priority Admission Review Panel, establishes the public-facing dashboard. At this point, I would turn it over to the testifier.
Thank you, Representative. First testifier is Sue Abderholden, and then if Danny Ackert and Jin Lee Palin can make their way up to the testify stand to testify next, that would be great. And let's try to keep our testimony to 2 minutes-ish. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I just want to point out this is a really difficult policy issue. We don't want people with serious mental illnesses languishing in jail. We don't want people with serious mental illnesses being in an inpatient unit for over a year and taking other beds offline. We don't want people in ARMTC, Anoka, who are ready to move to a less restrictive setting, sitting there on waiting lists. We want people to access the right level of care at the right time and at the right place. And it's important to understand a couple of things. One is that the number of people deemed incompetent to stand trial has increased significantly over the last 10 years since the 48-hour law went into effect, and not just in Minnesota, but across the country. We are the only state with such a restrictive timeline, and many states have no timeline at all. And some states have been sued and faced millions of dollars in fines. And there's no easy solution. It's a front door issue and a back door issue. When we look at the increased number of people in jail, we need to ask who brought them there. Could the situation have been addressed earlier through more intensive services, through crisis teams, through the use of transport holds? Could we provide more mental health treatment in jail so people don't further decompensate? Do we need more beds that are secure both in the community and in the state-run hospitals to better meet the needs? I want to give just a little history. So several years ago, you actually created a legislatively created task force to look at competency restoration. And we actually met for 2 years, came forward with a huge bill that is now being implemented to try to make sure that we stop that revolving door with forensic navigators. And then we created this priority admissions task force. And we met for a year. Last February, Representative Edelson at the time brought everyone together. We got to know Room 500 North very well, where week after week, we worked on a bill to create a final compromise. And I will say it was not easy, but it really reflected the all of the people's work on that. And that included county attorneys, county administrators, sheriffs, hospitals, of course, NAMI, and community providers as well. This year, we have had a little different process because of the lack of time, but I did try to go through and create the bill that matched with the recommendations of the task force. And I did create a chart so that you could see the actual recommendations and what the actual language is. And I just want to say that agreeing to these recommendations in the report was not easy. And it was actually the final hour of the task force where we finally kind of came to an agreement. And so I would urge you to really look at adopting the recommendations of the task force, because we spent all that really kind of hard, difficult time in getting there. And I just want to say that some of the key things is continuing our work to monitor the progress and transparency, keeping the current 48-hour law so that we, you know, don't put an arbitrary timeline in place that we can never meet. I also want to say that DHS can't magically come up with beds to meet the needs. The legislature appropriates funding for both the community and DCT, and so holding their feet to the fire, so to speak, by keeping the old 48-hour law doesn't actually produce anything. It doesn't help us at all. And just lastly, we need to keep all the things that Dr. Stevens talked about before in terms of bringing more medications into the jails, looking at the community side as well. And everyone has a responsibility to address this problem. Counties have a responsibility, excuse me, as a local mental health authority. Hospitals and community providers have a responsibility to expand their services to meet the needs. Our crisis teams, instead of police, will prevent more people from entering the criminal justice system. So again, please follow the recommendations of the report, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And welcome to the committee. Please state your name and title and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Danny Eckert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. MHA supports multiple provisions in House File 2586, representing the recommendations of the Priority Admissions Task Force. We have submitted a letter with further detail on our position for your consideration. I want to bring your attention specifically to Section 6 of the bill, which extends the limited exception to add up to 10 civilly committed community hospital patients per fiscal year to the wait list for medically appropriate admissions to direct care and treatment. MHA strongly supports this provision. Civilly committed patients in community hospitals awaiting admission to DCT often require unsustainable attention and one-to-one care, often with strict security and safety measures best suited for state-operated treatment facilities. Such situations are becoming far more common and forcing hospitals to close entire units to keep care teams, other patients, and the public safe, further limiting access to already strained hospital beds and high-demand services. Based on the figure you'll find in our letter, which is pulled from a recent DHS report on priority admissions, this trend unfortunately comes at a time when admissions from community hospitals to DCT are at an all-time low. Extending the 10-patient exception in Section 6 of this bill through 2027 will better serve civilly committed patients, free up critically needed community hospital resources to serve more patients, reduce violence and staff harm, and begin to address the ever-mounting number of avoidable hospital days across the state. I want you to think about the 10 patients. Not only if that exception is extended, they get better services, but then people in your districts, people across the state, then have more access to the care they need in community hospitals. So it's 10 to 100, almost. We also urge that the legislature understand that capacity is needed, not only at DCT, but also at community hospitals, and that dedicated funding and ongoing funding is needed to expand access to capital and the necessary workforce to successfully provide the services needed for all patients in need of care in state-operated treatment facilities and in community settings. Excuse me. In closing, we look forward to working with Representative Frederick, this committee, the legislature, to pull this bill forward in our view, especially Section 6 and the 10-person exception, in order to ensure that all patients have access to care when and where they need it. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, title, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning, members. My name is Jinlee Palin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. It's great to be here. Thank you. I am also a member of the Priority Admissions Task Force and later the panel. It was renamed in 2024. I represent one of the legislatively mandated organizations on that task force and panel, and I've served on it since 2023 through present. As a member of the task force, I'm here to also confirm the agreement that the task force and panel came to for the final recommendations in both the 2024 and the 2025 reports. I was also part of the group who helped draft and negotiate House File 4366 in 2024 with Representative Edelson's office, which included the broad group of stakeholders and partners that NAMI Minnesota had outlined in Ms. Abderholden's testimony. So the 2025 Task Force Report and House File 2586 are great continuations of the work 2024 started. The report notes that we have a front door and a back door capacity issue. And there is indeed a lot of pent-up need and a lack of step-down care when clients are ready for discharge from our state-operated services. And community mental health providers feel both the impact on both sides and we're ready to be part of that solution. For today, I'm here to speak specifically to the recommendations and proposals in 2020 in House File 2586 that emphasize funding the addition of the 50-bed facility to AMRTC and the staff to be able to provide the care needed for that service, to increase the Medicaid reimbursement rates to our community and hospital providers, and that is moving in House File 1005, to increase the funding supports for our mobile crisis team so that we might be able to help assist and alleviate the burden going to law enforcement when folks are calling from community with crises, and that is in House File 973. To increase the funds and supports for first episode psychosis programs and first episode bipolar programs. We believe this will greatly help mitigate and address some of these crises before they get to the point where folks are needing state-operated services. We also support the extension of the 48-hour rule sunset to 2 more years that will allow us to continue working on the panel and with you all as we're trying to solve this bigger problem. And as Mr. Ackert said, we are also in support of the expansion or extension of the 10-hospital patient exception into DCT. Community mental health, the mental health community, providers and advocates are well aware, as you all are, that this is a complex situation, and there are many systemic gaps in our system as we're trying to fix this problem. There are also many solutions to address it, which is why the recommendations in the report are so broad-based, and we support your good work in trying to sort out how to best solve this, and we really would urge your support and passage of House File 2586. Thank you, Representative Frederick, for carrying it, and thank you all.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public that would like to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Members, questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. My question is just regarding the conversations that were had with the counties and really what concerns they had and how this directly affects them with 2586.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. We just had the presentation where Dr. Stevens showed the graph of going up, how there's more civil commitments every year. And if you put yourselves in the shoes of a county sheriff, let's say, and you have an individual that's sitting in your jail, you're going to want to get that person out. And I think that's fair, right? And so the county position is that they may not have the capacity to provide services to the level that is needed for the people that are sitting in their jails. I mean, I think that's probably the situation in most counties throughout the state. And so they want to get people out. For those that don't know me, I worked as a direct care staff in St. Peter for more than a decade. And in that timeline, I can say that I saw firsthand, if you had someone committed from County A, from County B, and County C, every county would say, this is the worst case of mental illness we've ever seen. They're the most dangerous. We have to get them to St. Peter right away. I can tell you that is some cases, it was pretty extreme. I see firsthand the how bad mental illness can be and the harmful effects it can have on people, which is why we need to do the work that this committee does. But I can also tell you not all counties are the same. And so even sometimes where they say it's pretty extreme, when you look at it from a broader lens, that is not always the case. Doesn't mean that the counties have the capacity to deal with it either, so I'm not trying to minimize that. But I think of a case where, this was many years ago, where there was a county judge who civilly committed an individual who in the court, in his court filing, the judge said, I've seen this individual in my courtroom too many times, I'm gonna civil commit him, and kicks him off to St. Peter. So it is a challenge. It is a challenge of who gets sent there, which is why we do need to address capacity. But one of the things we're going to hear, and we probably a lot of us have heard, is that, oh, I've had somebody sitting in my jail for 100 days or 300 days or a really long time. Well, it goes back to that case of the people within DCT are trying to take the people in greatest need to get them to St. Peter to address that greatest need, which does mean in some cases, people who have that lower acuity maybe end up sitting in jail longer. And then if you, again, you put yourselves in that sheriff, you're gonna be upset. And I think that that's fair that they're upset. And so that's why we're trying to do this work today. That's why we're trying to say, we are trying to make the whole system better. We are trying to, Ms. Palin just talked about how we have on both ends, both on the admitting side and the discharge side, there's like challenges, right? Because we need that capacity, but we also need that capacity in the community, which is what this bill is, I mean, this conversation is about too, is about addressing that capacity. So I don't support the 48-hour rule in general, because if you have 500 bids or 500 beds between St. Peter and Anoka, yet you have judges that are saying we're going to civilly commit 600 people. What the hell is people going to do? Pardon my language, but for real. But that doesn't mean the frustrations aren't there at the county level. That's real too. So I think this middle ground is a good space. I think this bill is a good bill in that we can suspend that 48-hour rules, because with capacity not increasing, but the number of civil commits, I think it was a tenfold increase in the last decade. We have to do something. And part of that, what we have to do is this bill.
Representative
Chair, thank you, Representative Fredericks. My question was really kind of geared toward just the share, that conversation with the share. You know, my county commissioners have told me about episodes where it'd be $200,000 for a single person, you know, just from the cost side. So how did this conversation in 2586 deal with the share? And I certainly appreciate your conversation part about the sheriffs, but I'm just kind of getting an idea, what were the conversations like from the counties?
Ms. Abbott, I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
We've been flying here. Mrs. Abderholden, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, member. So this was all the organizations at the table for the last 2 years on this issue. And I can say that when you have a compromise, no one's happy. You know, everyone you didn't get everything that you wanted. We certainly didn't get everything we wanted in the report either. So, you know, what we had to look at realistically what we could do and how we could move forward. And so I would say, does it solve all the problems? Absolutely not. But does it make some headway? Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Madam Chair, just any examples from the counties? I mean, what were their conversations like? What were, you know, what was their impact to the task force?
They, Madam Chair, Representative, I mean, they're here and they can speak to it, but I would say they're very vocal, obviously, and I will let Ms. Youngerberg speak for the counties.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and title and answer the question.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I am the Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County Human Services and the MACSA President this year. Specific to the does not meet criteria costs, so the county cost share that you spoke to, it is quite significant. It is $2,200 to $2,300 a day when a person no longer meets criteria to be in the hospital in Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center. And the what was discussed in the task force was really revisiting the history of that, which was back in 2013. There was a cost share given to the counties as an incentive to get people out of the hospital and into the community. And that incentive was for individuals that were able to return to the community, incentivizing counties and community providers to bolster that level of service to get them out of the hospital. It is not the county's position to say that we want people to remain in the hospital unnecessarily. We want people back in the community as soon as possible so that they can fulfill their individual goals. The problem over time that has occurred is that as we have needed to do transfers between one state facility to the next, the way the language is written is that if the person no longer meets medical criteria to be in the hospital, in the current hospital that they're in, but they need to go to, say, the forensic hospital or another state facility, a state ERTS, for example, and that is the only place that they can go, the county is then charged that $2,300 per day while they wait. And we know, based on the data from the task force that was shown, that the wait time for forensics in fourth quarter, so regardless of, you know, where individuals are coming from, the wait average wait time for someone going into forensics was 527 days in fourth quarter last year. When you look at a six-month period of time, the average was 289 days. Multiply that by $2,300 per day. That is why counties are very concerned. These individuals are not returning back to the community, which was the original intention of that law. And so, therefore, basically, we are spending property tax dollars to pay for the cost of care for staying in the facility when we have no ability to influence that person's plan or where they're going.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you. That was a great explanation of it. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Frederick, for your work in this area. This is a really, really delicate issue, and we're looking at it from multiple angles, as I see on our agenda today. And you had mentioned a lot of your bills that we're going to hear today overlap, and I think for good reason. I think this is a good way to govern this issue, is to break it up. But I also just want to acknowledge that we're relying on state facilities that a constituent of any of ours could be committed to. And so, you know, we're serving folks all across the state with very limited resources, limited beds. We don't have enough appropriate placement for people of all ages. And so I would just ask this committee and other committees, as we proceed through our work this session, this is an issue that lends to the greater issue of folks not living in appropriate housing, period. And where do people go if there isn't a right placement? And so I would just, you know, again, ask members as you consider bills that maybe touch this area in your other committees that this is something that we've got to tackle as soon as we can with as many moving parts as possible together to try to move it all at once for the most immediate relief for the most people. And so to me, that looks like, I know we'll get into your other bills, but not only the policy to try to, you know, accommodate what we have right now by putting a pause on some things, but we know we can't just pause forever and expect a problem to go away. But, you know, as we consider the limited funds that we have, I do think it would be really wise of us to just be really strategic about how we're spending that money. And to me, it would be really strategic and a relief in multiple ways for our state if we invested in additional beds that are appropriate so that people aren't landing in the inappropriate care settings or on the street. So I appreciate the intricate work that you're doing in multiple bills. And at the same time, I hope we can pass all of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I didn't hear a question. Is there anything you want to add to that? Okay, thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And I actually am really excited that we're having this broader conversation because as the testifiers have brought up, there is not a magic drawer of beds where people can just open a drawer and be like, oh, here's a space for you. That doesn't exist. And it doesn't exist at the state hospital, but it also doesn't exist in our community as a whole. So in my community, I have a constituent who spent an obscene amount of time in Olmsted County Jail and also an obscene amount of time at Anoka. And I will tell you from the reason that person got there, the reason they were there is because they had autism and then had developed schizophrenia in their 20s, which happens. People develop schizophrenia regardless of if they have autism prior, right? And so we did not have the right support in our county to meet that very unique cross need. And they have a loving, supportive, amazing family. They had, they were doing all the right things to access services and supports. But the truth of the matter is there was not the right service and the right support in our community for that acute mental illness that then landed with a criminal charge. And that family had been begging for help for about 6 to 8 weeks prior to the acute incident because they knew something was going on. Everybody did. But until we build the whole spectrum and stop talking about it as DCT, jails, priority, and stop talking about it in these individual things, until we build the whole spectrum, itty-bitty kiddos to as Representative Linsicar talks about all the time, our elderly who are also experiencing mental health issues related to dementia. Until we build the whole spectrum for community, integrated, community run, and DCT, we are going to keep doing this. And this is tangent, but I'm going to mention it again. We sent 86 children out of state because we don't have the facilities here for children in 2023. So we need to start looking at it as a continuum. I think this is a good step, but I think we also need to say out loud every single time, there's not a magic drawer of beds. And if we, legislators, this committee, all legislators, this entire state, do not say this is a crisis and we are going to have to invest and create the beds, it will keep happening. And we will come back and we will have this conversation again. And everybody will ask, how does this keep happening? Because we have not made the beds. We have not invested in the beds, and that is just true.
Thank you. Representative Frederick, do you have any comment to that?
I agree. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for bringing this bill forward, Representative Frederick. Question, I don't know who, if it's for you or if St. Peter is here as well. We talk about the beds, and I know that we did some shifting of beds last year, dissolved a program in St. Peter to accommodate more beds. I can't remember how many beds that was. That was my first question. Was it 10 beds or more? 16.
Who would like to answer that one? Representative Frederick.
It was a 16-bed facility, Madam Chair.
Okay, 16-bed. Okay.
16. Thank you. Representative Gilman.
Okay, great. So my follow-up to that is, I know, as I had talked to several people that, and thank you for that you worked there as well, just that you have that experience of working there and providing the care for folks that are there. There are some beds available from my understanding, but it's just different levels of care that people need. And I'm wondering, have we thought about it with this task force, what is the greatest need and are those beds available? That's what I'm wondering.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to take a stab at this and then turn it over to the department if they have anything to add. In the forensics program itself, it is incredibly important to be intentional about leaving open beds on specific units, right? And when you think of just the forensics program as kind of a spectrum, right, you have the most acute and the least acute over here. And as people are being admitted, they might go to the most acute unit, right, and then they get treatment, medication, whatever it happens to be, and then they can work their way down that line. And that creates openings here. And those openings are there in case we need to take a new admit, but those openings are also there in case somebody on this that also resides at the facility, if something happens, if there's a violent outburst, if they relapse for whatever reason, that they have a space to go. And so we have to have open beds to a certain degree throughout the facility to be able to allow patients to move back and forth, and that's healthy. I've worked on a unit that was at the very end of that spectrum, the admissions unit, the crisis unit. That was where I worked for over six years. And we had, at the time, I think it was an 18-bed capacity, and there were times where we had 18 patients on that unit, and that was where staff were getting assaulted all the time, patients were getting assaulted. The violence that happened there when we maxed out on our bed capacity was always greater than when we had fewer patients on the same unit. Why? Because they could walk around. You weren't bumping into shoulders as you walked around the unit. And so just being able to decrease capacity in that way decreased the violence that happened. Now, since then, we've also, as a legislature, invested bonding dollars. There's it's a new facility now because it's been newly constructed to be able to make smaller units for that exact reason. But it's still very intentional to keep bed space open, even with the new construction, to be able to move people around. It was the care facility that was in St. Peter that we shut down as a care facility, which I actually talk about in my next bill. We're trying to get incentives to keep the staff working in what will be forensics, hopefully. we're hoping that they stay in forensics or work in forensics. But that will be another program under the forensics umbrella to be able to essentially increase capacity to a degree. And I don't know if that was enough or if you want anything more.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. And I think that's a really good explanation. Again, I'm just curious. I was curious about when people have those acute needs or they're coming from, from jail, the different steps, levels where they would go into at first and then, just, what's available, and it's good to know that, again, people may have relapses or slip-ups, when they're there and need to start back over from the beginning again. So I just didn't know the availability of folks that are coming in or needing that a lot of support versus the ones that are trying to get back out into the community. So that helps. Thank you.
I don't know if you want anything more.
Director Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Frederick spoke very well about forensic services, and we were on the same unit at the same time when those things were happening, so I can absolutely identify with what he was saying. I think for the rest of direct care and treatment, we are operating at a 93% capacity with wait lists on all of our programs for care to CBHH to our CAB program, et cetera. So we don't have beds that we can use that are, mothballed or available for use. And we're operating at as full of capacity as we possibly can. So no additional capacity currently, which is why the 50-bed addition I referenced a while ago was the recommendation.
Thank you. Any follow-ups? Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we made some significant inroads when we had the task force created, and we made some adjustments in where to place the individuals in the last 2 years, and I think we are making headway to have more programs. One of them is to provide care for those individuals who are in jail right now. What is the status of that, providing care of individuals who may be in jail right now? Dr. Stevens.
Director Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Noor. There are two pilots currently underway, one operated by Department of Human Services is to reimburse counties for cost of antipsychotic medications, which is a major expense for jails. The second is the pilot operated by Direct Care and Treatment, which is the jail consultation pilot. It's a small team made up of a handful of people, including a psychiatrist, pharmacist, nurse educators, to contract with jails, a small number of jails, to help them build capacity, teaching. I don't want to demean, because they do very good work there as well, but helping to enhance their skills around helping people to accept treatment while they're in jail. Because we know that when people get treatment earlier, their courses are better, they provide a safer environment, and sometimes they don't need to come to a DCT facility at all, especially when medications are involved. So those are the status of the two pilots currently right now.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stevens, does that include positive supports? Because most of the health institutions needed that support.
Director Stevens.
Thank you, Representative. Yes, absolutely, and that's why nurse educators are involved as well. Certainly, forcible medication administration is something that should be an absolute last resort, and many times is not needed when the positive behavioral supports are employed as a method to engage with people who are considering medications.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stevens, I think we've heard about the DNMC, which is something that is complicated. We understand that the counties have the option of what to do, and it costs almost $2,600 a day. We waived the payments in the last biennium through legislative process. How can we help the counties establish additional capacity within their systems to allow them to develop community-based programs or partnership with DCT? Is there any option using some of the funds that we collect for DNMC?
Director Stevens.
Thank you, Representative. I would actually defer to Sue on this. I will say that the cost of care goes back to the general fund, so that's within your purview to decide what happens with those dollars. But
that's right.
Ms. Abderholden?
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, that's correct. The dollars go back into the general fund, which then make it difficult to actually use those dollars to enhance our system and expand our system.
Chair Noor?
Just another follow-up. I know we are still waiting for the 1153 waiver for providing care in the jails. How close are we to moving forward with that waiver, 1115 waiver?
Who would like to take that?
Madam Chair, Representative Noor, I know that there was work being done on it. I remember getting an email from DHS, but where exactly that is right now, I don't know. I do know that one of the programs that we actually thought would help in the long term in terms of intervening early, it was called the Voluntary Engagement Services. That RFP is actually now posted on the department website, which we're very excited about because we've been working on this issue since 2020. And when we talk about, like Representative Hicks mentioned, the family knew that the person was heading toward a crisis, but until they're a danger to themselves or others, there's nothing you can do if they don't want treatment voluntarily. And this program will actually intervene and try to engage that person into treatment, which could help in the future.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll follow up on the 1115 reentry waiver. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And with that, any other questions or comments from the committee? All right. Representative Frederick, do you want to wrap up your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. It's a tough conversation to have. I do want to say, I want to be intentional about saying this. I think we all understand when it comes to the whole mental spectrum of services across the state of Minnesota, like this conversation really does stem talking about the people on the extreme end of that spectrum. And it's important to recognize the vast number of people who struggle with mental illness are not violent. They're good people. They're living among us every day. And I say this because it's also easy for me with my work experience to talk about these things interchangeably about the violence in the mental health population, but that's purely because for a decade I worked on the crisis unit at the end of the spectrum of these statewide services. So it's, I guess, just important to me to recognize that, or to verbalize that mental health is a thing, and that there's a lot of people that struggle that are not violent. Just in case any of my comments today have given any other impression, I just wanted to make sure that I'm saying that. So it's a tough conversation. It's going to be ongoing. You know, we need to be able to expand capacity at the same time, and I hope to be able to have the support of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, members. With that, House File 2586 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next up, Representative Frederick. House File 2187, do you want to move your bill in front of the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House File 2187 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
And then should we start with the amendment?
A1?
Yeah. Or A2?
A2, I'm sorry. Would you like to move that in front of the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment does a few different things. Puts $15 million into the electronic health systems technology projects. It addresses what I kind of talked about when we were talking about the care facility. We want the staff of the care facility to stay working within direct care and treatment within DHS, or will now be DCT. However, there's been some challenges with administering that retention program, and so I just decided to take action legislatively to spell it out. And so it's on the last page of the amendment. That is not new dollars. That's money that's already been appropriated, so that is not new money that's getting put in. I actually talked with Chair Schumacher before the committee and have an oral amendment on this, and that is on page 13, line 34, where it says 2026, I need to would offer an oral amendment to have it say 2027. So just moving it another year, if that is, if I can get the approval of the committee for that oral amendment.
Great. Let's move the A2 first and vote on that, and then we'll do the oral amendment to your amendment. Awesome. Any questions or comments on the A2 amendment? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That passes. Now your oral amendment to the A2.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the oral amendment would just be changing the year 2026 to 2027 at the very bottom of the page on line 13.34.
Any questions, comments, or concerns about?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to get the non-partisan staff.
Sure. Would you like to explain the oral amendment?
Madam Chair and members, the oral amendment would read page 13, line 34, delete 2026 and insert 2027.
Fantastic. Any questions, comments, or concerns? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? That passes. Noted. Representative Frederick, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is the DCT technical bill, which is going to be even more interesting when we get to my next bill, because there's a lot of technical changes to talk about the executive board. So there's technical updates within this bill. But it also, so part of the reason for that change from 2020, I probably should have said this during the oral amendment, was that part of the incentives, I actually want to extend it out for over the course of 2 years, which is what the need for the language change to 2027. But this also then, when we talk about capacity, right, we've been talking about capacity with the previous bill. We've been talking about capacity in general for a really long time. this bill would fund, if we can, fund the Miller Building at the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Facility, right? That building would be able to decompress, essentially, all of the jails throughout the state as a way to address all of the concerns that we're hearing from our counties and from DHS. Now, it's imperative on us as a committee, too, that we don't allow that capacity to build, or that backlog to build up again, that we are proactive in doing this. But this would at least address the capacity needs that we have right now. And with that, I would turn it over to the department to explain the bill, too.
Welcome to the committee, Director Briones.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Carrie Briones. I'm the Legislative Director for Direct Care and Treatment. A few weeks ago, I was here speaking to this article in Chair Schumacher's larger DHS policy bill, so I'll try to give you a bit of a Cliff Notes version of this rather than read the same testimony off to you again. Most of the this bill really is technical changes that we made by working with the revisor after last session, going through all the statutes that impacted DCT, looking at them to identify and update them in preparation for when DCT assumes the statutory authorities as a separate agency on July 1st of this year. There are a number of sections identified that contain various protections, duties, and authorizations that apply to DCT that DCT still needs to have as a separate agency after July 1st. Where appropriate in the language, DCT or the executive board were added so that once DCT does assume the responsibilities on July 1st, it's a seamless transition and those remain in place. These sections do not create any new or modify any existing protections, duties, or authorizations that we do not currently have at DCT. It simply extends those. There's also sections of law that were missed last session that were subsequently identified by the revisor where references need to be changed to DCT or the executive board. There are two sections. I point you to sections 30 and 37 that modernize terminology around our community-based services programs. And this work really was a result of our clinical staff going in and looking at the statute and seeing that the language was pretty outdated, didn't reflect things such as Olmstead and wasn't person-centered, and used some really outdated terminology. And one example was a community providers. I can't remember what the term was, but as someone that doesn't do that type of work, it wouldn't have been even clear to me what that meant. And then I would also point you to section 74, where there are some repealers for outdated language that is no longer applicable. And section 9, which Representative Frederick I spoke about a little bit, was about the sunset provision related to the medically appropriate bed for priority admissions.
Thank you. And with that, do we have anybody from the public that wants to testify? All right, public testimony is closed. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Morning, Madam Chair. My name is Angela Youngerberg. I'm the Director of Business Operations for Blue Earth County Human Services. I am MACSA's president, and I'm here on behalf of AMC, MACSA, and MICA, and I served as a member of the Priority Admissions Review Panel, Task Force, then Review Panel. I am testifying today to raise a concern about lines 41.7 to 41.10 in House File 2187. I truly appreciate Representative Frederick's leadership in seeking solutions. This session on the priority admissions issue, it is a highly complex issue, and appreciate that he is sponsoring a bill that seeks bonding to invest in a DCT capacity increase that is essential. From the presentation earlier today, you heard on the review panel report, there were several things that were of importance that are related to this. The continued upward trend for the demand for priority admissions, the persistent significant wait lists for priority admissions to DCT, and as referenced earlier, in the last 6 months of 24, there was a significant average wait time to access the appropriate beds, particularly forensic services, an average of 289 days, and access to Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which was an average of 27 days or above. The priority admission statute originated in response to the lack of access and inpatient capacity at DCT. It's a problem that still persists today, clearly. I want to be clear, this is not a problem of direct care and treatment not doing what they need to do to serve people. They clearly are. This is a resource issue that exists, and DCT cannot solve this alone. Please note that the recommendation about the need for increased capacity at DCT is also inclusive of increased capacity needs in the community. On page 23 of the panel report, the report highlights the estimate of what the potential cost is to address the nearly 350 people that are currently on the priority admissions wait list through added DCT capacity. So we had a conversation within the priority admissions review panel to say, what would it take to address the current need and demand? And direct care and treatment was able to come forward with information, and it's listed in the report, and it's striking. 350 people are still needing, or 350 beds would be needed to address the current issue today. That is an $800 million price tag, and it's significant, and it would be a significant expansion of the state-operated services. And so again, we recognize that DCT capacity is not the sole solution. We know it's part of the solution, but it is not included in the governor's proposed budget or bonding proposal this biennium or last. To emphasize this, the language from the report is very important. The headings that are shown are accurate, but I want to read one line from the report. The review, and this clarifies where the review panel members were finally able to come together. As you've heard, it was tenuous. The review panel members agree that the sunset provision of 253B10 subdivision 1E should be extended for a period of 2 years, which must be conditioned on funding to increase capacity at DCT and the community. That's an important provision. It is not a two-year reprieve to wait to study. It is conditioned upon increased capacity. The need is urgent, and you have heard that today. To the A2 amendment, gotta get my notes here. MACSA and AMC and MICA appreciate the inclusion of the $75 million replacement of the Miller Building at AMRTC. Tying that increased capacity to any proposed changes to the 48-hour rule is a key component of the county coalition, but also is key to the final agreement of the entire priority admissions review panel. This is an essential down payment to the current need. I will also note that lines 1.4 through 1.16 raises some concerns, but we have talked to Chernor and are committed to working with him on those clarifying pieces. And so in closing, the work of the review panel has been extensive, and we do truly need the buy-in from the legislature and administration to fund the necessary solutions. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you. Any other testifiers from the public? All right, we will close that portion and members' questions. Representative Gilman.
Thank you so much, Chair. And my question again here is for Ms. Youngeberg, right? Okay.
Yes.
So just curious for the counties, do they have, so in where each of these hospitals are located, is there an extra burden on the counties, and it's their responsibility, the tax base, the taxpayers in that area, to fund or help fund these hospitals in these situations? Or is it, that's why you're saying there should be bonding, the governor needs to prioritize folks with DCT, like in DCT, and then also, you know, us here at the legislature.
Director Youngerberg.
Sure. Chair and Representative Gilman, I would say that individuals from across the state of Minnesota need to access care at any facility within the state. So it is not necessarily because I live in Blue Earth County, that if I had a family member that had a need, they wouldn't go to the hospital necessarily closest to me. The fact is, they would go to any hospital that has that opening. And so there is not the local contribution to the facility nearest. The local contribution that does not meet criteria funds that the counties pay go into the state's general fund, which then supports the rest of the budget, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so there isn't just that direct local connection, if I was understanding your question correctly. And so we really look at this system statewide versus regionally. There are a lot of things that we do in mental health that are regional. Our adult mental health initiatives, our community capacity building is very much regional focused. But when it comes to the inpatient side of care, we are driving all over the state to get people the access to services that they need.
Representative Gillen, follow-up?
That's good. Thank you.
Anybody else? Representative Frederick, you want to do your closing?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Clearly, this bill represents that other bookend that I said during the last bill, right, where the complete removal of the 48-hour rule, right? The task force is that middle ground where it just suspends it for those 2 years. Yes, it's important to tie it to that funding of the new facility at the Miller Building. So if there's bonding dollars available for it, that would be great. There is that concern, though. It just does come back to whatever we can do to increase capacity as a state to address the mental health needs, we need to do it. So I just appreciate this committee support, and I would renew my motion to lay over House File 2187.
Thank you. House File 2187, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Frederick, House File 2037. Would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House File 2037 be laid over for possible inclusion.
And I believe you have a D1, DE1?
I do. The DE1 amendment, what it does is it takes the language that has happened over in the Senate and brings this bill to conform with the same language as what's passing in the Senate. Specifically, it does things like, the whole bill is about establishing a commissioner instead of the executive board. One of the things that the DE1 does is also says that we will have a CEO report to the commissioner. And the reason for that was there was a concern expressed that direct care and treatment is the arm of the government that is providing direct services, right? And we want to make sure when it comes to providing those direct services, that health care, that we, to a degree, insulate that from politics. And I hope, most of us can understand the need to separate out health care from politics. To a degree, and that's what this amendment—it's one of the things that this amendment does—is establishes the CEO underneath the commissioner, and all the other feedback that they've done on the Senate.
Thank you. Any member discussion or questions on the DE1? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes. Representative Frederick, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill, what it does is establishes a commissioner for DCT instead of the executive board model. What I've stated in this committee previously when we had presentations from the department, one of the things that I asked is that in a secure treatment facility, is everyone responsible for their own safety? And the answer is obviously yes. But you still have that safety officer, right? Why do you still have that safety officer? Because you want that accountability. My concern with the executive board model is that this executive board will meet a minimum of only 4 times a year, and that's it. They hire the CEO. The CEO then runs all of Direct Care and Treatment, which is a billion-dollar agency. If that CEO were to do something egregious that we don't support as a legislative body, our ability would be extremely limited, right? We know that the legislative process is very intentionally one that is supposed to take a while. We're supposed to have these long conversations, and it can take a year for us to act and make changes. With the executive board model, even the governor wouldn't be able to come in and say, hey, that thing that you did, whatever it happens to be, he couldn't fire that CEO. So this bill is about accountability. It's about accountability to the people of Minnesota. It's making sure that we have a system in place that when we are looking at spending a billion plus of taxpayer dollars, we have the ability to say, hey, that's not okay, and take action quicker than just legislative action. So I think that it's important to have this conversation, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Are there any testifiers? Anybody from the public want to testify on House File 2037 as amended? All right, public testimony is closed. Member questions? Chair Schumacher.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick, for working on this bill. I understand, well, I don't understand it. that's not what I meant. Just for the public's information, we do intend on having Representative Frederick become the chief author of this bill. It was originally Representative Schwartz with this. We had talked to her initially with this because the St. Peter's in her district. She may have an interest, but Representative Frederick has a lot of experience in this area and probably a few more opinions on how this should work. So my only question, Representative Frederick, I know that this isn't exactly how you would have set this up, but you want to be part of the conversation with this, and I'm very grateful for that. And whatever we can do to be supportive in your version of how this should look, we want to stand behind you on this and help with that and work with the Senate on that, and so whatever we can do for that. But if you could tell us maybe a little bit of how future iterations might look with this, I'd be grateful to hear.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Chair Schumacher. I've reached out to you several times, right, about my ideas for this and what I think we should do. I wasn't originally in the camp that we should take this piece of legislation up, which is why I was also hesitant to become the chief author of this piece originally. I think it's important too. We heard the department come up and talk about that continuity of care, right? That executive board model where somebody is appointed, they serve a term, and they are able to provide that long-term continuity. And I think there's value in that. And my initial starting point was, how can we still achieve the accountability that I'm looking for, that I think is lacking in the executive board model, without going to the full commissioner structure? And I was asking a lot of questions to that extent. Where else do we see that in state government? Do we see that in anywhere at this scale? And the answer was no, we don't. We don't see the executive board model anywhere else in state government at this same scale. It's not that executive boards don't exist, but not at this scale. And so it was important to me to try to address some of the continuity stuff, which is also why I talked about the CEO structure, and there's language in the bill that talks about the person that gets hired to become the CEO also has to have background in things like behavioral health, in running a hospital, and have that kind of experience, which I think is what the executive board was hoping to be able to hire as well. And so we're trying to incorporate that as part of this, but at the same time still going for that accountability. And so that's not seeing anywhere else that exists in state government that has the level of accountability that I'm looking for. That's why my position changed from let's try to keep some sort of executive board, but change it. My position changed from that to, yes, I do believe at this point we do need to move to that commissioner model, just like every other state agency, because we need that accountability. So my position has evolved over time, and perhaps I should say thank you to Chair Schumacher for letting me go, taking him along with my emotional journey on that one.
Emotions, no.
Thanks. But that's what, but it, because I landed on the space where I want that accountability, and I couldn't figure out how else to do it other than going through this, which is then why I finally said, yes, I'm more than happy to take over this bill to really try to push this conversation to the committee to see if we can't figure it out together, really, because I think collectively as a committee, we're going to end up with a better product than if it's just me even.
Chair Schumacher, any follow-up?
Yes, I'd just thank Representative Frederick for his open-mindedness on this and his willingness to deal with the issue and not the personalities with it to get to a better result at the end of the day. So just thankful for that.
Chair Norris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Frederick. I think for sharing with your lived experience and the work that you do. I know as part of the conversation from last year, we deliberated extensively on the model that we're seeing right now. It kind of mimics the DCT is a safety net hospital for the state of Minnesota. And we looked at different models, you know, like Hennepin Health and different places and different hospitals which are run by an executive board and they have a CEO. And similarly, I think that structure is what compelled us to put a system whereby we can have an executive board run the safety net hospital for the state of Minnesota so they can become nimble, so they can be able to address things as they go. So I think given that, the board is already in place. Board members have been appointed. They go through the consent of the Senate, including the next step of making sure that they can take over that operational process. They're already being trained. They're given all the tools that they need to hit the ground as soon as the separation happens. And I think I will be more than happy to continue the conversation of which model should we go forward with. So I appreciate you bringing this bill forward with Representative Schwartz. So I look forward to having that conversation as an ongoing. So thank you so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to go after the two chairs, but I'm on the Rare Disease Council, and we operate a little differently, too, and it's a model that I think is closing in on what you're doing. So on the Advisory Council for the Rare Disease, we have representatives that are part of it and just are part of the conversations along with area experts, and I think it's been a really productive way of doing it. So I like where you're going with this. I do have a question, though, about the advisory council. What do you see it looking like? Do you have same discussions as far as what the way we handled it in the Rare Disease Council? Is it similar?
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Murphy. So the advisory council does exist. Right. I keep the advisory council in this bill to make sure that those conversations continue to happen. So they still have so all of the people that are on that council still have a voice at the table to be able to advise the commissioner and the CEO about what this should look like, what this agency should look like. So I wanted to be intentional about maintaining as much as we could of what existed with the executive board model, and the advisory council was part of that. And so that still exists here to make sure that those voices are represented. I think that answers the question. If I didn't answer it in the right, let me know.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up. So the Rare Disease Council uses two representatives and two senators. And so they're part of the discussion, so they are all active in it as well. So those are members of the Rare Disease Advisory Council. And so I'm one of those members representing the House. So I was just curious if you have any, stipulations like that would include any of our elected officials as being part of the advisory council.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me find where it's called out specifically here.
Madam Chair.
Chair Knorr.
Within the advisory, we do have legislators who are appointed. I think Representative Vanek is one of the appointed individuals who are serving in the advisory council for the DCT.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Representative Murphy?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Curran?
Thank you, Chair. And thank you again, Representative Frederick, tackling this issue from multiple angles. And just sort of having a background in nonprofit where things are always run by a board, there's the aspect of having a board and having a group of people from different walks of life reviewing things that is really beneficial to leadership of certain types of organizations. But as I hear you talking about this and sort of, you know, the board meeting four times a year and having, I'm a board member myself, when you're a board member, that board takes up a fraction of your time as a professional human, right? And a commissioner, the idea is that that's that person's full-time job. And that's, to me, the key here that sort of gets me on board with the commissioner model, is that, well, I think well-intended to have a board. I like the advisory piece of it, but the executive board isn't this full-time governing board that's in place all the time to tackle the day-to-day issues. And not to say that people aren't committed to the role that they have on the board, but that role is very, very limited to the scope that they're actually practicing and very limited in time that they're dedicating to the cause. Again, that's not to say that the folks doing it aren't dedicated, but the portion of their lives that they're dedicating to it are small. And I think when you have somebody with the responsibility of a commissioner, the state then is saying, we want somebody dedicated to this full time. You mentioned the aspect of accountability, which I think is crucial. But also, I think that lends to continuity as well. If we do this right and we can keep a commissioner in a position for a good amount of time, I think we will see some better results under a commissioner model. So I've sort of taken that journey with you, and I appreciate you taking us for the ride.
Representative Frederick, did you have any comments to that?
Hope everyone's having a good ride.
Any other member questions or comments? All right, with that, Representative Frederick, would you like to do your closing?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, again, to me, it's all about accountability. And I'm not saying that this is perfect, but I want it to be part of the conversation that this committee has, which is why it's important to me. It's important to me because of my work in this space. And I think that we talk about transparency often, we talk about accountability often, and I want to make sure that we get it right, which is why we're having this conversation today, which I'm grateful for. So I just want to thank all the committee members for that. And with that, I would renew my motion to lay over House File 2037 as amended.
And with that, House File 2037 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you. And members, with that, there are no more items on our agenda. We get to come back tomorrow morning at 8:15, March 26, 2025. And with that, we're adjourned.